Welcome to the latest global news recorded at 15 hours GMT on Monday, the 17th of May. I'm Oliver Conway with a selection of highlights from across BBC World Service news today. Coming up, Iran has struck a nuclear deal with neighbouring Turkey, which Tehran hopes will undercut the case for further sanctions. Also in the podcast, a report into the future of NATO says the alliance needs to become more versatile and quicker in its response to military situations.
NATO must maintain a flexible mix of military capabilities, including conventional, nuclear and missile defence.
A new deadline passes for anti-government protesters to leave their camp in the heart of the Thai capital, but neither side is backing down.
The deaths have been caused by the government. If the government wants to stop the killing, the government should stop shooting immediately.
The government will continue to tighten the cordon around the protest area.
And we travel to Japan, where robots are being used to teach immigrants Japanese so they can continue working in the country. But first, Iran has signed an agreement with Brazil and Turkey to send some of its low-enriched uranium abroad in return for higher-grade nuclear fuel for a research reactor. In a move aimed at averting further United Nations sanctions, Iran said it was ready to ship 1,200 kilos of uranium to Turkey. An official said, however, that Iran would continue to enrich uranium. Turkey said the agreement meant there was now no need for new sanctions against Iran. I asked our Tehran correspondent John Lyne, who's monitoring events from London, to explain the specifics of the deal.
Well, under this agreement, I've seen the text of it now, Iran is supposed to ship out, or said it's agreeable to ship out this a batch of low-enriched uranium to Turkey within a month, and then a year later, Iran would expect to receive the higher-enriched uranium for its, or medium-enriched uranium, really, for its Tehran research reactor. If it didn't get that material within a year, if the West didn't come up with its promises, then Iran would then reclaim its stocks of low-enriched uranium. Now, what the agreement doesn't specify is what happens to Iran's stocks of low-enriched uranium if that fuel doesn't come through, or if that fuel does come through. Does Iran then... where does that go? Where does that low-enriched uranium go? Because under the original deal, that low-enriched uranium was actually going to be processed and would actually become the new fuel for the Tehran research reactor. That doesn't seem to be the sequence of events according to this new agreement.
Now, if Iran does send 1,200 kilograms of this low-enriched uranium to Turkey, does that mean it no longer has the uranium it needs to make a nuclear bomb?
Well, that it would, I think, in the West, hope at least postpone that that eventuality. Of course, Iran is continuing to enrich uranium, although there have been some problems at the Natanz enrichment plant, and it would be left with a little bit anyway, and it has been making some since the original deal was made in October. Nevertheless, yes, it would delay Iran's progress towards the capability to make a nuclear bomb. Not that anybody is accusing Iran of actually trying to make one right now.
And what will the US and other Western nations make of this after we have the French foreign minister talking about progress in talks on imposing sanctions on Iran?
Well, I'm not sure the sequence of when the French foreign minister said that exactly, but I think the intention, first of all, will clearly be to keep, as it were, Iran's feet to the fire, to keep the pressure on Iran so that the whole kind of coalition for new sanctions doesn't collapse just because of one agreement. So the first thing will be, if they're agreeable to this, to make sure Iran delivers and keep the pressure on Iran to do that. I think at the same time, obviously, they will be looking at the very fine print of this agreement to see if it all stacks up and if they can go with it.
John Lyne. The future of NATO is on the agenda at its headquarters in Brussels today. A group of experts led by the former US Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, is making recommendations on how the alliance should adapt to a range of possible challenges. These include the future of Afghanistan, relations with Russia, and missile defence. Presenting the findings, Mrs. Albright said NATO must maintain versatility to respond to new challenges. But she said there was agreement that maintaining security for NATO members was the organisation's primary role.
The security of each ally cannot be separated from that of all. NATO must maintain a flexible mix of military capabilities, including conventional, nuclear and missile defence. It must also conduct appropriate contingency planning and military exercises so that allies may feel confident that their borders will indeed be protected.
From NATO headquarters, here's our defence and security correspondent, Nick Childs.
The world has changed significantly in the decades since NATO's last strategic review, as this report acknowledges. It also warns that while the alliance is busier than it's ever been, its value is less obvious to many than in the past. According to the report, NATO leaders should use the opportunity of developing a new strategy to highlight the alliance's contribution to security and stability, or the organisation could fail to retain public backing. Collective defence remains a core commitment, it says, but it also underlines the commitment to Afghanistan and the need to guard against threats further afield. Highlighting a difficult balancing act for the alliance, it says it should pursue a policy of engagement with Russia while reassuring all allies that their security and interests will be defended. It warns of a threat to alliance cohesion from the complexity of the modern world and says that NATO must now cope with the threat of terrorism, cyber attacks, and the proliferation of nuclear and other weapons technologies. It describes missile defence as an essential mission.
Nick Childs in Brussels. In Thailand, a government deadline has now passed for anti-government demonstrators to abandon their camp in the commercial heart of Bangkok. It is a no-go zone. Tens of thousands of troops are surrounding about 10 square kilometres occupied by the protesters. Banks, hotels and restaurants are closed, there's no public transport, and residents have been told to evacuate. The protest leader, Weng Tojikaran, has been telling his followers to stand firm.
The deaths have been caused by the government. If the government wants to stop the killing, the government should stop shooting immediately. Immediately. We have been demonstrating here for almost 2 months, and before that, we have demonstrated many times. There were no losses before, but right after the government ordered the shooting, there were casualties. The government has caused people to die in the killings, so if the government wants to stop the killing, then they should stop firing.
However, the government is showing no sign of backing down. A minister attached to the Prime Minister's office, Satit Wong Nong Toi, had this warning for the protesters.
We would like to urge fellow citizens to be careful and to protect themselves. The government will continue to tighten the cordon around the protest area, but we will try to minimise the impact on those living in the vicinity.
At least 35 people have died since Thursday night, including a renegade general who'd joined the Red Shirt protesters. A short time ago, Claire Balderson spoke to the BBC's correspondent in Bangkok, Rachel Harvey, and asked her if there was any sign of the soldiers moving in to disperse the protesters.
There are no signs of the soldiers visible from the protesters' camp, and that's where I've spent most of the day. But it's noticeable that as you go to the southern perimeter, for instance, where there's a huge barricade and where the demonstrators have been facing off with soldiers for weeks now, that was the point where the soldiers were first brought into town. It was an area that the demonstrators used to gather in large numbers. They were determined to defend their territory. It's now utterly deserted. I've just come from there. There are abandoned belongings just strewn across the concrete. I saw a motorbike helmet, some shoes, some bedding, all just left behind as if people had gone in a hurry. But the further you go into the camp, the more people you see. So right in the centre seems to be where people are congregating now, as if they feel that that's perhaps slightly safer. Well, as I say, I just got back from the camp, and this was the scene a short time ago.
We've just come to a Buddhist temple in the middle of the protesters' camp, and this is where the government have told people to come if they want safe passage out of here. And I'm looking at a tent which has got a Red Cross sign on it, and there's a long queue of people snaking out from that tent. There's a Red Cross official here. Can I just ask you your name?
My name Pim, P-I-M, Pim, from Nonthaburi.
Pim, OK. And can you just explain for me, in Thai if you prefer, what are all these people doing here who are queuing up? Are they waiting to leave? No, these people are not leaving. What we have here is the Thai Red Cross have set up here at this temple to give donations for people. They've got toothbrushes, toothpaste. They're not for people that are leave, but what we've seen is that for the children, the young children, what they have is they have skin problems and they're also getting sick. So in fact, these are people that are just coming to be treated and given supplies. They're not trying to leave at all. They're planning to go back into the camp.
เขาต่อสู้อยู่นะคะจนนาทีสุดท้ายค่ะยังไงเขาก็ต่อสู้เขาไม่ได้หนีกลับ
They're fighting they're not going to leave they're going to continue to fight until the very last moment I'm a woman I'm here to fight
Well there was one other woman that I spoke to in the queue and she was very very emotional she told me that she'd been part of the protest since the beginning back in the middle of March and she just kept pointing at her hands to me and saying look I have absolutely nothing but I'm determined to stay here why are they killing us
Rachel Harvey in Bangkok. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. In Europe, the volcanic ash cloud from Iceland is disrupting air travel for a second day. Here in Britain, Heathrow and Gatwick airports were closed during the night. They have now reopened, but services will be restricted, in particular arrivals at Gatwick. In the Netherlands, the main airports at Amsterdam and Rotterdam were also shut for a large part of the day. Nkem Ifejika reports.
The direction in which the ash cloud drifts determines which airspaces could be affected by closures, and this can be an unpredictable science. But at the BBC Weather Centre, they say that by daylight GMT on Tuesday, the ash cloud should have cleared away to the southeast corner of England. But that will probably mean restrictions for northern France and perhaps the Netherlands. The closures have been recommended by national air traffic controllers in conjunction with Eurocontrol, which is the pan-European body. They are monitoring the drift and concentration of the ash. The main problem for passengers tends to be a lack of information. These passengers were stuck at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam.
This is our national day in Norway, 17 May, and we have to stay in Amsterdam. So I hope we come back to Norway, perhaps tomorrow. So it's happened.
We have two ways to go. We can go back with my brother-in-law,
or we can wait here
after us, or we can wait.
Yeah.
So we're not sure what we're doing.
In April, during the last major disruption, there were complaints from some airlines that the closures were too restrictive. They lose millions of dollars every day if they're not allowed to fly. So it is perhaps understandable why they'd be upset, especially if they feel the restrictions are unwarranted. And once again, there's been some criticism. However, the director of the National Air Traffic Service here in Britain, Ian Hall, said that safety was paramount.
The engine manufacturers have been very, very clear. If they were able to come up with a level of ash concentration which they thought their engines could operate in safely, then the restrictions would be able to change. But they're the experts, as the ones that are saying that, so far as they can make out, there's no different rationale. And as long as safety is our priority, and it is from an air traffic control point of view, we simply have to take the advice of those experts.
For passengers in the affected areas, the advice generally is to check with the airlines before going to the airport.
Nkem Ifejika. If you thought the 5 days of political horse trading after Britain's general election were exciting, spare a thought for the people of Iraq. More than 2 months since they went to the polls to elect a new parliament, there is still no government. A recount of votes in Baghdad has now confirmed a narrow victory for the Sunni-backed candidate Iyad Alawi over the incumbent Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. But no single party won enough seats to form a government on its own, and talks to form some sort of broad coalition, including Shiites, Sunnis and Kurds, could still be messy and protracted. Gabriel Gatehouse reports from Baghdad.
This is Demosine Radio, a small local station in Baghdad, and the programme that's going out at the moment is called Ya Sam'in Al-Sot, which roughly translates into English as Hello, is there anyone out there listening? Hadi El-Mehdi is the station's presenter, and basically he's urging listeners and Iraqi politicians to solve this impasse that's more than 2 months old now quickly, and warning of the dangers of what might happen if they don't.
We believe that Iraqis have done their national duty by casting their votes, but what is happening inside the Green Zone is putting the future of this country in danger.
So what is happening inside the Green Zone more than 2 months after the people cast their ballots? Well, a partial recount of the vote has just been completed, but that has delayed certification of the official results for weeks. There have also been legal challenges to a number of candidates to bar them for alleged affiliations to Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. Serious negotiations on forming a government have barely got underway.
The political wrangling, this attempt to ignore the election results, politicians trying to cling onto power, all of these things endanger the future of Iraq and the future of democracy, the democracy we all want to defend.
If the situation will stay like this, it will take a long time to form a government.
Fala al-Nakib was Iraq's interior minister under the American-appointed administration, which lost power to Shiite parties after the country's first democratic elections in 2005. Now he's a prospective MP. He stood on Iyad Alawi's ticket, whose party was largely backed by Sunni voters. He now wants the Americans to step in to solve the deadlock.
We need to form an Iraqi government, a national Iraqi government. The United States, they founded the political process in this country. So I think they have some influence over certain groups. They can make it clear to them. Otherwise, the country will be pushed toward a civil war, actually. We need, especially for the time being, we need a national unity government that's accepted by everybody.
Last week, a wave of bombings and shootings killed more than 100 people in a single day. An increase in violence has reinforced fears that the political deadlock would provide an opportunity for insurgents to strike. But most people seem to agree with the need for a national unity government of some sort, even those politicians in the Green Zone now jostling for positions. The question is more about who gets which ministry and who becomes prime minister. The Americans have made it abundantly clear that they're not going to take a hands-on approach. They're focused on their withdrawal. Meanwhile, the Iraqi people waits.
Gabriel Gatehouse in Baghdad. Language tests in Japan are proving a barrier to foreign workers, badly needed in some areas such as nursing, where there are severe shortages and an ageing population. To stay in the country, foreign nurses must pass tough language tests, but only 1% of people taking them passed this year. It's highlighting the difficulty Japan may face if it continues to keep tight controls on immigration while its workforce shrinks. Some Japanese hope technology will provide an answer, as our Japan correspondent Roland Burke has been finding out.
Come to a place like this and you can see Japan's demographic crisis in close-up. There are around 50 elderly people in this hospital, almost all of them in wheelchairs, many of them attached to drips. Nearly a quarter of Japan's population is already over 65, and the proportion is growing rapidly. Now, Japan has allowed in some foreign nurses in recent years to help. One of them, Excelsis Bourbon from the Philippines, is here.
I came here to enhance my profession, and I also want to make my mom happy. I just want her to feel that I can stand on my own.
But learning Japanese is a huge challenge. After his shift, Excelsis and a fellow Filipino hit the books. To stay longer than 3 years, they must pass an exam, including the complex kanji, or characters, used to represent medical terms. This year, out of 254 who tried, just three got through. Even for badly needed foreign nurses, there are barriers to immigration.
It's really very difficult, but we really need to study this.
And how many do you have to learn?
I don't know, but I think Japanese kanji, they all have around 50,000.
I'm in Tokyo's main station now, and looking around me, the vast majority of people are Japanese. Now, many people here cherish the idea of one homogenous nation. And even though the workforce is set to shrink by a third by 2050, the idea of making immigration easier is barely discussed. Well, I'm off now to Osaka to see what may be an alternative. Now we've come here to see the unveiling of one vision of Japan's future, in which machine increasingly takes the place of man. Now in the corner of this room, on a sofa, are two women. Now at first glance you might think they were twin sisters, they look very similar. But look closer, and one is in fact a robot. Now, this robot has been developed by a man called Hiroshi Ishiguro.
We can use this robot as a bystander in a hospital, right? So you can imagine, you know, the patient needs to talk to the doctor, and usually, you know, the patient will be nervous about that. But if, you know, Android is here and, you know, synchronized with the patient, the movement, then the patient can relax.
So almost like a sympathetic mechanical friend. Right.
Not mechanical. This is very human-like. Nobody knows what is inside of this robot. Right?
Now, up close, this robot really is extraordinarily lifelike. It's a real size, and it's kind of fidgeting, moving its head, blinking in a very realistic way. And if it really feels a bit rude to touch, but if you touch its face, its skin is soft and rather like a human being's. It's actually quite unnerving. Now, Japan has a shortage of people, or it's going to have a shortage of people. Mm-hmm. Is this a robot's solution?
I think so. Well, you know, everything is going to be a kind of a robot. Always innovation saves the world.
An outlandish vision? Well, maybe. But Japan has been automating its factories for years. It's home to 1 in 3 of the world's industrial robots. For a country that needs more people but doesn't want immigration, unleashing robots into the wider world may just be the logical next step.
Roland Burke in Japan. An iPhone application has been launched to help protect the rare Congolese mountain gorilla. Our Africa editor Martin Plaut has been following the story.
From deep in the forests of eastern Congo, you can now follow the lives of families of gorillas on your mobile phone. Videos and updates of these great apes can be downloaded via an application on iPhones. Each application costs $4, with most of the costs going to fund the protection of the gorillas. The Virunga National Park is home to 200 mountain gorillas who live in this volcanic region. 160 wildlife rangers have died in the last 10 years, saving these rare animals from poachers, rebel groups and land invasions.
Martin Plaut reporting. And that's all from us for now, but an updated version of the Global News podcast will be available for you to download in 12 hours. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.